Welcome to Second Request, the podcast where we explore solutions to monopoly problems. I'm your host, Teddy Downey, and we've got a great episode today. We're discussing the FTC's proposed ban on non-compete agreements with Sandeep Vahizan, legal director at the Open Markets Institute. Sandeep, thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks for having me. It's my pleasure to be here.
I want to do a quick, I always do this with you because Capital Forum's been around for 10 years, but you were the first, you did our first conference call and our first event. I think it was on an airline merger. I don't even remember which one. It was so long ago while you were at AAI. So I always like to remind people, Sandeep was one of the earliest Capital Forum enthusiasts, I think. So can't thank you enough for sticking with us over the past 10 years.
Absolutely. You and your colleagues do great work. And I've learned a lot from the reports you put out. And I will correct you, the event was on beer, not airlines.
Oh, it was on beer. Oh my God. I can't believe I got that wrong. So was it ABM? Was it Grupo Modelo? ABM Bev Grupo Modelo?
Yeah, that was one of the big mergers happening at the time. And
wow.
I wrote worked on a report for AAI about the merger and why it should be stopped. And talked with you and your colleagues about that.
That was what kicked off the company. So a little bit of history there for everyone. And with that, maybe you could walk us, I'd love for you to walk us through all the work you've done over the years, advocating for this rulemaking and the research that you've done and the reports that you've done, because I think I don't want to miss out on that. I think everyone should have that perspective to kick things off here.
So this has been on my radar and my colleagues' radar since 2018. There was a great deal of reporting on non-compete clauses at the time, how employers were using them with workers up and down the income scale. They weren't being used just with CEOs and other high earners. And we were very interested in what the FTC could do in labor markets. I've done a lot of research on the FTC's unfair methods of competition power and realized that this is a really important statutory authority that the FTC had been sitting on for decades. Like, it had done nothing with it since the 1970s. And so building on research I've done, the excellent research of people like Evan Starr, Open Markets, along with a number of other public interest and labor groups, the AFL-CIO, SEIU, Public Citizen, the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, we petitioned the FTC in March of 2019 to do an unfair methods of competition rule banning non-competes for everyone, no exceptions. And we didn't file this petition with an expectation that the Trump administration would act on it. We were skeptical that they'd take any action. Instead, we viewed this as a way to shape the antitrust agenda for the next Democratic administration. So our public-facing work began almost 4 years ago. And since then, we've been writing letters, op-eds, blog posts, urging the FTC to act. And the Trump administration, so the FTC under Joe Simons, to their credit, did a few things that we didn't expect. So they held a public workshop on non-competes in early 2020, invited public comment on non-competes. So hundreds of workers submitted comments to the FTC describing how non-competes have hurt them, derailed their careers, forced them to stay in abusive, discriminatory environments. So the Simons Commission collected some important evidence and started the process of building the evidentiary record for this rule. At the same time, they signaled pretty clearly that they weren't going to do a rule. They were merely interested in studying the problem. And so we just kept banging the drum and saying the FTC needs to act, the Biden administration needs to act, the president needs to appoint the right people who want to use the FTC's unfair methods of competition power, including against non-competes. And I would add that non-competes have been an area of great interest to the president for years. So when he was vice president in 2016, he spoke out about the injustice of non-compete clauses, and he's talked about them with regularity since then. And we were very excited when President Biden, in the July 2021 executive order on promoting competition in the American economy, among the 72 recommendations, encouraged the FTC to do a rulemaking on non-compete clauses. I thought this proposal would come somewhat sooner, given the people the president has appointed to the FTC, given the president's personal interest in this topic, given the work that had been done before he even took office in January 2021. But still, we're very delighted to see the strong proposal that came out earlier this month that did what we asked the FTC to do almost 4 years ago, a blanket ban on non-compete clauses, no exceptions based on income or occupation.
And, you know, why do you think it's important to ban them all rather than, you know, just for low-income earners, which is, you know, I think a lot of people are trying to get the FTC to narrow the rule that way.
That's right. So a number of people, centrists, more conservative academics and commentators have said the FTC should do something more targeted, focus maybe only on low-wage workers. So I think the evidence supports a complete ban. So these contracts certainly hurt low-wage workers, but they also hurt the wages and wage growth of middle and even higher earning workers. So there's actually a study from, I think, the early 2010s that finds that non-competes hurt even corporate executives. So people who typically negotiate their employment contracts, hire lawyers to review the details. Even people at the very top of the income distribution are hurt by non-compete clauses. And so those are just some of the quantifiable effects. If you look more broadly, non-competes trap workers, prevent people from leaving for greener employment pastures, starting their own businesses, escaping toxic work environments. So the wage effects are important, but they're certainly not the only harms from non-compete clauses. And I'd add that the harms from non-competes aren't solely about employers taking their workers to court and getting injunctions preventing them from starting a new job or establishing their own business. The mere existence of non-compete clauses has a chilling effect. People generally believe if they have a non-compete that it's enforceable, and understandably, people don't want to be dragged into court. They don't want to be sued. And so employers exploit you know, most of our understandable desire to just follow the rules and avoid getting in trouble with the law. So even in California, where non-competes have been unenforceable for the past 150 years, a significant fraction of workers have non-competes. So the harms from non-competes, their mere existence, is very real and has been documented through empirical research over the past 10 years. And further, and we can talk more about this, non-competes don't have any legitimate justifications. Employers have less restrictive, more targeted alternatives to protecting trade secrets and other proprietary business information. And most importantly, if employers want to retain workers, they can simply pay them fair wages, treat them well, and offer regular raises and promotions. So they have a number of other alternatives. They don't need non-competes.
Yeah, let's just stick with that because, you know, if you are a company and you look at this and you're like, well, I actually don't want to be engaging in unfair methods of competition or something the FTC thinks is unfair, but I still want to protect sensitive information or otherwise put some restrictions on employees who, you know, in other ways that are not unfair or that aren't prohibited. What are the options available to them?
So when it comes to protecting information, they have several tools at their disposal. So for trade secrets, we actually have a specialized body of law called trade secret law that prohibits the unauthorized disclosure of confidential information. And trade secret law carries serious penalties. People have gone to prison for disclosing trade secrets. So employers have that very powerful tool in their pocket. So apart from that statutory tool, they have other contractual tools. So let's make this concrete. Let's talk about a hypothetical example. Let's say you have a medical practice with 20 doctors. One of the doctors wants to leave and start her own practice in the same community. That medical practice may have invested a significant amount of money in building its base of patients. They understandably don't want this doctor to strike out on her own and take all the patients with her. In a situation like that, the medical practice can use something called a non-solicitation agreement with all its doctors. And under a non-solicitation agreement, a person, once they leave, cannot actively recruit patients or other customers from their former employer. So non-solicitations can be used to protect patient lists, customer lists, and the associated investment that the firm has undertaken. So those are two, one statutory, one contractual tool that employers have that are more targeted and less restrictive than non-compete clauses. And then, as I mentioned, employers should be using carrots instead of sticks to retain staff. I get why employers like non-compete clauses. They restrict worker mobility. They don't have to pay their workers. They don't have to offer pay their workers fairly. They don't have to offer raises and bonuses to keep them. But that's not how we want labor markets to work. We want labor markets where employers constantly feel pressure to retain workers. We want them to feel a little bit scared. And we've seen that in a number of sectors of the past 2 years, notably in fast food, where fast food chains are fearing worker departure for the first time in a long time. And what we've seen is higher wages and better benefits. And we want that dynamic to occur across the economy in all labor markets. And outlawing non-compete clauses is one way of doing that. Employers will feel more pressure to treat their workers well and offer good wages. And they've already come out and said that if the FTC does ultimately ban non-compete clauses, that's what they're going to do. There was a nice piece in the Wall Street Journal last week where lawyers and consultants for employers said, yeah, we might just have to start paying workers better and offering them promotions if non-competes go away. So they're publicly acknowledging that they have other methods.
Yeah, I get the sense that also, to the extent that people have real concerns about trade secrets and things like that, they're moving, and I think this was mentioned in the same article, that the companies will move toward those types of options also, that they were sort of using non-competes as sort of a blanket way to address everything, but that they can just be more targeted in how they write up their contracts. So yeah, it does seem to already be having an impact.
Exactly. And I would add one other point. So when it comes to protecting proprietary information, non-competes aren't actually a great tool. And I highly recommend an article by law professor Viva Moffitt on this topic. It's actually called The Wrong Tool for the Job. And she describes why non-competes are a poor fit for protecting business information. So in a nutshell, you know, non-compete restrains a worker from leaving, finding another job in the same industry or the same line of work, or starting a business in the same industry. And you kind of see the mismatch between what a non-compete does and what the ostensible purpose is. So it broadly restrains worker mobility in the name of protecting some discrete piece of information. So facially, it seems overbroad. It doesn't actually target what it's trying to protect, which is trade secret or other valuable intangible. You know, at the same time, a non-compete doesn't actually restrict the unauthorized disclosure of information. So let's say person is unhappy with their boss, wants to stick it to them, and one way of sticking it to them is leaking a trade secret to a rival. A non-compete does nothing to prevent that. And, you know, so long as this illicit disclosure is not traced to its source, the person could get away with it despite having a non-compete. So on the one hand, non-compete is overbroad, restricting labor market mobility. On the other hand, it doesn't actually stop what it's supposed to stop.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, you know, to the extent that companies are writing contracts that address the actual issue that they want to address, makes more sense than kind of using this sort of blanket non-competes, these kind of broader non-competes. And, there's been a little, we've gotten a lot of questions, I know, about the sort of tactics or strategies that would effectively amount to a non-compete. I was wondering if you could talk about that, and if there's any, you know, any ways that this rule could be even further strengthened or clarified or improved around those edges, sort of, in terms of like, well, it's not a compete, but it's basically doing the same type of thing.
Yeah, so we've already started to see employers move away from traditional non-competes. So a number of states have restricted the use of non-competes. Bills have been introduced in Congress to prohibit non-competes. And now the FTC has proposed a blanket ban. And so employers are trying to develop functional equivalents of non-compete clauses. And I'll highlight two. So the first is something called a training repayment agreement provision, or TRAP. And my friends at the Student Borrower Protection Center have really done yeoman's work in exposing and publicizing the evils of these contracts. And so under these contracts, what an employer says is, we offer our workers trainings. In fact, we mandate them to attend and participate in certain trainings. If they leave within a certain period of time, let's say they leave within 2 years of joining, they have to compensate us for the training that we've provided them. And in traps that I've seen, the dollar figure has been as high as $50,000, $75,000. So a significant sum of money for nearly all of us. And what these contracts do is they function as a de facto non-compete. They discourage people from leaving. And in some important ways, they're even broader than non-competes. So non-competes restrict a person's ability to work in the same industry or work in the same line of work in the same occupation. What a trap does is it deters all types of departure. So let's say someone wants to leave to take care of a sick parent. Under a trap, they would have to compensate their employer, even though they're leaving not for a rival or another firm in the same industry, but to stop working and to tend to their parent. So traps are even broader than traditional non-competes, and troublingly similar, very striking similarities to involuntary servitude, whereby people are effectively forced to stay in place and work for their current employer. So that's one. The second is something similar. It's called a liquidated damages clause, where a person is being told that if they leave, they have to pay their employer a stipulated amount. The amount isn't necessarily tied to training. It's the employer's estimate of how much economic harm they sustain when a worker leaves. And the proposed rule, covers these contracts, but I think it could be clarified and strengthened. I think the final rule should establish a blanket ban on these contracts, whereas the proposal only prohibits at least traps if the dollar figure that the employer has included is unreasonable. And I think that that unreasonable provision could be a source of a great deal of mischief. And as I mentioned earlier, employers don't use these contracts, at least with most workers, with an eye of going to court to enforce them. They recognize that they have significant deterrent value just on their very own. And I worry anything short of a blanket ban on non-competes and these functionally similar contracts like traps will encourage employers to keep using them.
But does there have to be something at least open-ended a little bit? Because, all right, you've identified traps and you've identified these liquidated damages clause, but for the people who really love their non-competes, they're gonna come up with a third and a fourth and a fifth novel contract clause, I would imagine. Do you still have to leave something open-ended that's sort of like, if it effectively works like a non-compete?
I think that's right. The rule has to be drafted expansively to cover contracts that are functionally like non-competes, not just contracts that are identical to a non-compete. And I think the rule does that in significant measure, because you're right, employers and their counsel are very creative and imaginative. If X is prohibited, they'll figure out something that is functionally identical to X. And yeah, the FTC needs to draft a broad rule that'll allow it to go after, the new non-compete, non-compete 2.0 or non-compete 3.0. But I think this will be an ongoing process. I think the rule won't be the FTC's last word. I think the FTC will also have to obviously enforce the rule against firms that refuse to comply, but then also offer guidance to industry saying that, yeah, just because something doesn't have the word non-compete in bold letters at the top doesn't mean that it's okay. And so guidance and future enforcement action will be important to ensure that the rule and the spirit of the rule are effective.
Anything else about the rule that you think is interesting or important or should be changed or anything that stands out to you? I know that something that jumped out to me was that the employers are required to notify the employees that their non-competes are illegal, or they have the notification seems important. Anything else, anything like that that sort of strikes you as important to discuss?
Yeah, so the notification piece is really important. So the rule would make existing non-competes null and void, and employers have to tell their employees that they are null and void and can no longer be enforced. So that was a really strong and positive piece of the rule. I think one area where the rule could be strengthened is the intersection between non-competes and no-poach agreements. So these contracts are often mentioned in the same breath, but they have some differences. So a non-compete is a contract between an employer and an employee. No-poach is a contract between two employers or two firms. So these are contracts that an employee may never be aware of. And under current antitrust precedent, no poach, no hire, other forms of collusion among rival employers is per se illegal. And the DOJ has been enforcing this prohibition through criminal actions. So the law on horizontal no poach, no hire is pretty clear. This conduct is illegal. It's subject to criminal prosecution. There's a little bit of ambiguity around so-called vertical no-poach, no-hire agreements. And so these are contracts that have commonly been seen in fast food franchise contracts where McDonald's and Burger King will tell their franchisees, you shall not hire workers from another McDonald's or Burger King or someone who's worked recently at a McDonald's or Burger King. And these contracts have been litigated. They've largely disappeared thanks to the enforcement work of Washington State AG Bob Ferguson, but they still show up outside of fast food and in, for example, staffing contracts. These have been a mainstay of third-party staffing arrangements for years. And I think the FTC rule should cover these vertical no-poach agreements because there's some disagreement right now whether these contracts are per se illegal or subject to the rule of reason under the Sherman Act. I think they should be per se illegal under Sherman, but that's a question that will take years to litigate, and I'm not confident the courts will get it right. I think the FTC should just ban them through this rulemaking.
Have you looked at the comments? Because this comes up in the comments. I mean, the comments are just so heavily weighted towards healthcare, and I think we've seen this type of thing in healthcare as well. I'm curious to get your thoughts on if you've read the comments, and I mean, you've obviously read a lot about public comments around this, but I mean, have you read the comments? I mean, I'm just curious if you've taken a look at them yet.
I have not had a chance to read the comments yet. I've seen people read them and post about them on Twitter, and the comments thus far are overwhelmingly supportive of the rule. I believe Axios had a story last week which said that out of the thousands of comments filed so far, only one was against the rule, which is pretty incredible. And the outpouring of support is very encouraging. I'm confident this proposal is going to attract hundreds of thousands of comments, maybe even over a million comments. But the fact that we're already at 6,000 or 7,000 and it's only been 3 weeks is a very encouraging sign. And you're right. From what I've seen, doctors and other medical professionals have been very engaged in supportive of the rule, sharing their experiences with non-competes. Many people don't know this, but a significant fraction of doctors today aren't part of a practice or solo practitioners. They're employees of a group practice or a hospital, and a significant fraction of them have non-competes. And they've been vocal that non-competes not only hurt their careers, but they can hurt their relationships with patients. If I have a longstanding relationship with my doctor and they choose to leave and can't resume practicing elsewhere because of a non-compete, that hurts me. And this is something that's happening on a large scale across the country. So non-competes in the medical profession are not only about worker justice, they're also about protecting patients. And so prohibiting non-competes, as the FTC proposed to do, will have significant salutary effects for public health and welfare. And I think doctors can provide important support for the rule, describing their experiences with non-competes, describing how their patients were hurt. And I think also explaining how non-competes aren't just harmful to low-wage workers, because doctors are typically high earners, they're privileged professionals. And in spite of all that, they're hurt by non-competes. They typically don't negotiate their non-compete. They worry about violating a non-compete and facing lawsuits. So I think doctors can help shore up the case for a blanket ban instead of something more targeted.
Yeah, especially on the note, you know, just on something where, you know, like specific, like these no poach, no hire agreements in vertical situations. A couple other things that came out of the comments. One, I was really surprised how many people consider their own non-compete to basically indentured servitude. I was very surprised by that. I mean, I get it, but I didn't think that people would feel that way. It also seems counterintuitive. Like, these people don't want to work there. You know, like, you're keeping people don't want to work there and work there. I don't know. It seems very bizarre. But yeah, that really jumped out at me. And the other thing about the comments was a lot of them are also like hospitals. And, you know, some of those are going to be for profit and covered. But like, I imagine there's actually kind of, I couldn't tell. They don't say, hey, well, we're not covered because we're a nonprofit. But I am curious to get your thoughts on all the industries and that have regulators that are not covered by this rule, and whether or not you think, you know, I saw in the American Prospect, proposals that, hey, you know, you need other agencies like the Department of Transportation to implement something similar so that you can actually affect all employees across the economy. What's your take on that?
So I'll start with the nonprofit exemption. So this has been a hotly debated issue for a number of years, and it's the question of whether the FTC Act covers nonprofit institutions. And the way I read the FTC Act, I think it does. So it covers persons, partnerships, or corporations. And corporation, if I recall correctly, is defined in a way that excludes nonprofits. So nonprofits aren't a covered corporation, but they certainly seem to be a person. So I think the FTC would have quite a strong argument that nonprofit institutions in healthcare and elsewhere would be covered by the rule. Putting that aside, you're right. The FTC has jurisdiction over most of the economy, but not quite all. And there are some important exceptions. So I have the text of the FTC Act in front of me. So it doesn't have jurisdiction over banks, savings and loan institutions, and federal credit unions. Then it also doesn't have jurisdiction over common carriers, air carriers, and foreign air carriers, and then also persons, partnerships, and corporations subject to the Packers and Stockyards Act. So basically, banks, airlines, and meat packers fall outside of the FTC Act. So we would need other agencies such as DOT, the bank regulators, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture to enact analogous rules to ensure that everyone in the workforce is covered.
And does Open Markets have any plans to advocate for that? Or
we've been thinking about it, and I suspect we will write something calling on these agencies to follow the FTC's rule and do something similar. And, you know, DOT, for example, has unfair methods of competition authority. So if they so choose, they could copy and paste the FTC's rule and make sure that it applies to airline workers as well.
What's your view of the legal outlook for this rule and also for Section 5 rulemaking more generally?
I'm probably more optimistic and confident than many people, but I am very aware of the legal risks. So I think there are at least two important legal risks facing this rule. So the first is, does the FTC actually have the authority to write competition rules? It clearly has the authority to write consumer protection rules under the Magnuson-Moss Act. A number of people, including people who I think of as sympathetic to progressive anti-monopoly policy, have said the FTC does not have the authority to write competition rules. And bear with me for a second. I don't find that argument persuasive. And just because the plain text of Section 6B of the FTC Act says otherwise. So, 6G, not 6B. 6G has the header Classification of Corporations Regulations. And it says from time to time, FTC can classify corporations, except as provided in the Magnuson-Moss Act, to make rules and regulations for the purpose of carrying out the provisions of the subchapter refers to the entire FTC Act. If I'm a textualist, that provision, which I read, answers the question pretty unambiguously. The FTC can write rules, including competition rules. I don't see any wiggle room. The text doesn't say procedural rules and regulations. It just says rules and regulations for the purpose of carrying out the provisions of this subchapter. So I think the FTC is on fairly strong textualist grounds to do this rule as a UMC rule. You know, that said, we've seen over the past few years, judges do what they want. If they find something ideologically objectionable, they'll find grounds to strike it down. And there's a great deal of hostility toward progressive administrative action in the courts right now. We should be under no illusions about that. I think a second bigger threat is something called the major questions doctrine that was announced quite recently by the Supreme Court in the decision West Virginia versus EPA. And this is the idea that if an agency tries to regulate a so-called major question, the court offered some principles on what constitutes a major question, but I think it's a rather subjective inquiry. If an agency like the FTC tries to regulate a major question, it can only do so if Congress clearly gave it the authority. So there has to be something in the underlying statute that says the agency can regulate the following practices. And so I think the major questions doctrine is probably the biggest threat to the FTC rulemaking on non-competes. But even there, I think the FTC has some pretty good arguments, and I'll offer two. So the first is non-competes are a type of vertical restraint. And so these are contracts between someone and a buyer-seller relationship. And vertical restraints have been a focus of antitrust law and FTC enforcement action for decades. In fact, some of the earliest antitrust cases in the United States involved challenging vertical restraints used by large corporations. So the Standard Oil litigation was partly about vertical restraints between Standard Oil and railroads. So I think that's one response, that this is just another vertical restraint. Vertical restraints are in the wheelhouse of the FTC's work. The second is non-competes specifically have been the stuff of antitrust law for a long time. You know, to be sure, the FTC and DOJ haven't really done much on non-competes in recent times, but if you look at the early history of the Sherman Act, if you look at the common law on restraints of trade often refer to practices that prevented someone from doing work in a particular occupation. So you have history that supports the idea that the FTC isn't really doing anything novel or unprecedented here. It's actually doing something that's been at the core of antitrust law and policy for more than 100 years. So to summarize, I think the two big questions, among others, will be, does the FTC have the authority to write competition rules? And second, is the FTC regulating a major question that Congress didn't authorize it to regulate? Judges will do what they want to do. But the FTC is on fairly strong legal grounds if and when this rule is challenged.
Yeah, the major questions, you know, it's got a lot of tension with Chevron in some ways, because it's like be very specific and evidence oriented and clear and don't come up with arbitrary exemptions and stuff like that. That's Chevron. And then the other one's like, if it's too broad and too, you know, then we're going to whack it for being too much of a question, too broad of an authority. So it is an interesting dynamic Supreme Court has created for these agencies. What about major questions? They have to worry about major questions on the, Is it only apply to the rule, or can they apply major questions to the FTC using their unfair methods rulemaking authority? You know, like the broader point.
Oh, so a rule targeting another practice.
Yeah. That was another thing. I mean, it's just kind of like, how would they apply it? Anyway, I've just been curious about exactly. I mean, it's hard because, to your point, it's a bit of a very vague and seemingly arbitrary standard, right? They said it's only extraordinary circumstances and only when the authority is not clear. Well, the authority is, like, at least you're arguing, is clear, but it's powerful, right? It's a broad power, so that the FTC has. So, you know, if you ideologically want to take a chunk out of an agency's broad authority, I don't know. I'm just curious what you.
Yeah, so I'll quickly mention non-delegation as well. So this is the idea that, you know, there's a constitutional provision saying that Congress shall not delegate its legislative powers to other branches of the government or other parties. And a couple of the conservative justices want to revive non-delegation. Although I think with the adoption of major questions, I think non-delegation will recede a little bit. In some ways, major questions is a more open-ended, powerful tool for them. And I'd also add that Congress has been delegating administrative functions to agencies since the founding. This is not something that started with the New Deal or the progressive era and Woodrow Wilson. There's been a lot of good writing in the past few years describing the delegations that happened in the 18th century. So that the idea that delegating policymaking power to agencies as a 20th century creation is just false. So I think that's another, but, you know, nonetheless, despite what the history says, you know, so much of conservative jurisprudence is informed by bad history. So non-delegation is another threat that we need to be aware of. You know, the broader UMC power question, yeah, it's hard to say how broadly major questions sweeps. Does it cover only rulemakings, or does it also cover significant adjudications? Does it cover even guidance statements that affect a great deal of economic activity? We don't know yet. I think we'll get a better sense in the coming months and years, especially with how the lower courts are interpreting and applying major questions.
What do you make of there's been this conservative argument from some conservatives that, look, when Congress came up with Section 5, antitrust law was much narrower. And okay, yes, it does, you know, expand authority beyond what antitrust law was before. But since then, antitrust law has become much broader in terms of an authority, and there's no need for Section 5 as a legal argument. Just want to get your take on that, because that's the most prominent. I think that's one of the more prominent arguments I've seen attacking FTC's unfair methods of competition rulemaking authority.
So it's striking how similar things are today to when the FTC was created in 1914. So why did Congress create the FTC? It was partly in response to the Standard Oil decision, where the Supreme Court said, going forward, only unreasonable restraints of trade will be illegal. And it is the responsibility of the courts to figure out what's an unreasonable restraint of trade. So the Supreme Court engaged in a power grab in Standard Oil, and Justice Harlan in his dissent called them out for doing that and said, this is an example of judicial legislation. The decision provoked outrage in Congress and among members of the public. And Congress passed the FTC Act to effectively reclaim power from the courts. Set up this agency to be the national policymaker on competition. And the agency would do that through adjudication, through rulemaking, through guidance, through oversight of industry. And we're in a very similar situation today, where the Supreme Court has said the Sherman Act is a common law statute, and it's our duty to identify both the ends of the law as well as the doctrinal means. And so we're facing a need for Congress directly and indirectly through agencies to reclaim policymaking power. And so I think Section 5 is maybe more relevant than it's been since 1914. So the idea that somehow we can trust the courts to make good antitrust policy is just wrong. And just look at some of the recent decisions where the court, based on quote-unquote economics, is further weakening restrictions on monopolistic practices and other restraints and restraints of trade. So I think Ohio versus American Express is a good example of that, where the court adopted this fanciful concept called two-sided markets to make rule of reason cases even more difficult for government and plaintiffs to win.
You know, I've looked at it a little bit differently, and just in the sense that the logic of the argument just doesn't make sense to me, because there's an acknowledgement that Section 5 is broader. So if you think about it, you know, as a circle, you know, okay, this is a circle that goes around antitrust law, you know, Sherman Act. Okay. Well, if even if it's true that antitrust has broadened, you know, in terms of the body of law, even if that is true and you, that circle is expanding, the other circle would subsequently also expand if the definition of Section 5 is that it's a broader authority, right? It would also get bigger. So I just don't, I'm at a loss personally, just trying to evaluate it as a legal argument, but I couldn't agree more when it comes to the major questions issue. I mean, that's really does seem to be where the rubber meets the road.
You're absolutely right. The FTC Act was enacted to be broader than Sherman and Clayton, and the Supreme Court and the courts of appeals have repeatedly said that. And, you know, let's assume Section 5 is a dumb law. It represents dumb policy. Well, it's still the law. And that's still the FTC's mandate. And if these conservative critics of anti-monopoly think it's bad, they should make their case to Congress. And I think this commission and the chair have been very good about emphasizing that they were charged with policing unfair methods of competition. That is their statutory duty. And for them to disregard that constitutes civil disobedience. And I think for too long, the FTC has said, we're not going to use this power, even though Congress gave it to us. And in terms of the FTC, the breadth of Section 5 and unfair methods of competition, I'll give you a quote from 1986. So this is well into the Chicago school era. It's a decision called FTC versus Indiana Federation of Dentists from the Supreme Court. And the court wrote, the standard of unfairness under the FTC Act is by necessity an elusive one, encompassing not only practices that violate the Sherman Act and the other antitrust laws, but also practices that the commission determines are against public policy for other reasons. So you have a decision from 1986, so during the Reagan presidency, by which time the court had moved significantly to the right, saying that the FTC Act is broader and covers things that the FTC deems are against public policy. This was a unanimous decision too, so there was no dissent from any of the conservative justices. That language seems clear to me. And your circle, concentric circle metaphor captured it perfectly. You have a circle encompassing the Sherman Act, then you maybe have a slightly larger circle capturing the Clayton Act, and then you have an even broader circle that's the FTC Act, and that's the law as it is.
I spent months trying to figure out the details of arguments that sort of, you know, gave so many commentators conviction that this would not hold up in court. And I was just really underwhelmed when I saw the arguments. I get it. Major question.
You're not alone.
Yeah, major questions is interesting because, yeah, but it, you know, that makes sense to me. But the other stuff I had a really hard time getting people to drill down on it with me. And it's just one of those times when there was this real consensus, and it was kind of fake. To be honest, it was kind of fake. It was just people hadn't done very much work to go back and actually study it. And I sort of would have expected more, just given that you had written a paper, Rohit and Lena wrote a paper. I'm Shere Khan and FTC, former FTC commissioner, now a CFPB director, Chopra. Just given that there were papers about it. And
I've also been struck by the arguments of the critics thus far. I thought they'd be much more compelling. Instead, it's turned out to be kind of the same old stuff, the standard theoretical arguments for non-compete clauses, arguments against the FTC's authority to write rules. What else? Idea that higher earning workers aren't hurt by non-compete clauses. It almost seems as though some of the critics haven't read the proposal. The proposal reviews the evidence, including evidence not supportive of the rule, at great length, and explains why the commission reached the tentative conclusion that it did, and also talks at great length about alternatives to non-compete clauses. So I notice this especially on Twitter, but I think some of the people attacking the rule should actually set aside a couple of hours, maybe half a day, and read the proposal and accept that, yeah, the FTC is aware of the arguments against the rule. The FTC is aware of evidence maybe supporting a more targeted approach, and came to a reasonable and eminently defensible conclusion that a complete ban is the right approach.
And I'd say the last thing that I find interesting about this, at least how it plays out in the courts in particular, is there are probably going to be less popular politically rules down the road. But I mean, just looking at the initial comments, how overwhelmingly specific they are, and how the various industries, how emotionally charged they are. If you have, however many years this would take to get to the Supreme Court,
mm-hmm.
of people expecting their non-competes to be banned, and then they take it away. I mean, they're not dumb people. They're not like completely detached from society. They might not want to use their major questions doctrine on this one. I mean, I'm curious to get your thoughts on that. Just like how much, I mean, the public comment period, how much that changes. I would say both individual sort of the decision making by judges, and also, even corporations when they have a choice. We could do this now, or we could wait and see what happens in the Supreme Court. And they just look at the comments, and they just say, well, this is probably worth doing anyway.
Yeah. So two really important points in that question. So the courts are political institutions. I think at this point in 2023, it's hard to deny that. They're not constrained in the same way members of Congress are, or the president is. They're not worried about losing re-election, but they do care about public opinion, and there are areas where they're willing to be bold and frankly audacious, and other areas where they realize maybe restraint is the right approach. So if you look at the Lochner era from 100 years ago, the Supreme Court was striking down a lot of progressive legislation, but it wasn't striking down everything. There were good laws that survived judicial challenge then. And I think that experience should counsel some optimism that agencies and Congress will be able to do things and survive judicial challenges because they're doing what's popular, and the court doesn't want to go out on a limb on everything. And this is an issue where there's broad ideological support for a ban on non-competes. This is not an issue just for progressives or self-identified Democrats. And you've seen this in Congress. The Workforce Mobility Act that was, I believe, introduced last term had bipartisan support. So the main sponsors were Chris Murphy, a Democrat from Connecticut, and Todd Young, a fairly conservative Republican from Indiana. And so this is an issue where there's broad bipartisan trans-ideological support. And for a court to strike this down would be doing something immensely unpopular. So I think you're right. I think they might keep their powder dry on this one and shoot down something less public, less visible, as a way of saying, FTC, we still have your eye on you. Don't, just because your rule survive, non-compete rule survive, doesn't mean that you can do whatever you want. And on the second point, I suspect some employers will stop using non-competes even before the rule is finalized, just because they want to maybe distinguish themselves as a better employer, as a high road company. And maybe they'll also think a little bit more critically about why they're using non-competes and realize, actually, we don't have any real need for these contracts. Why not get a PR boost by not using them anymore?
Yeah, I mean, we don't use them here. It's been a bit of a competitive advantage for sure.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of, I think we have a lot higher retention among our employees, and people seem to like it here. So I think it's generally been helpful. So as a very, very, very limited natural experiment, there you go.
Right. Exactly. I mean, yeah, it creates goodwill among employees. Non-competes are ridiculously one-sided and they're not going to engender trust and respect among workers. Like, well, my boss is so afraid of my leaving that they've tied me down with this contract. Like, that can't be good for morale.
Yeah, I would just never want someone to work here because they have a non-compete. Like, that's right. That's not a reason that to be at it, you know, to have a career. I this is a bit of a, like, you know, I think, look, my industry, you know, the industry I'm in, specific to my industry I'm in, I don't have, you know, it's just, you couldn't get good work out of someone who didn't want to be there. I'm sure there are other industries that don't operate in the same way. But at the same time, if you are a conscientious employer, you'd think, well, I'd much prefer them to be here for them actually wanting to be here than feeling constrained about leaving. I think a good example, I mean, this is in a lot of management books or whatever, but like, and I don't know if this is exactly analogous, but, you know, Netflix is like, they'll pay you to leave if you, you know, I don't know if they still do this, but, you know, if you don't want to be there, you know, that seems a little bit weird, but it's a similar concept. It's just like, you know, it's hard to do, have a great product if the people who are there don't want to be there.
Yeah, exactly. It's the employer should desire to have motivated, loyal workers who are happy to show up every morning and do the work.
Yeah, seems like a better model. It seems like a better competitive advantage.
I'd also add one other quick point. So related to this, so I'm a fan of competition rulemakings. I think the FTC should be doing more rules. A couple of reasons are rules are harder to undo. Future administration has to go through the whole APA process again. And I think rules also have an important norm shaping function where if an agency says something is bad and illegal, that obviously carries the force of law, but it's also a signal to the public and business that this is immoral. You know, the FTC Act speaks about unfair methods of competition. So apart from the legal effect, I think this rule will have a positive norms shifting effect. And that's harder to do through adjudication or guidance. I'm hoping we see this materialize with employers publicly saying we're no longer using non-competes. I think Microsoft may have committed to not using non-competes last year. Maybe they did it for independent reasons. Maybe they saw that non-competes were going to be restricted. But I hope other employers come out and say, yeah, we're going to get ahead of this regardless of what happens with this rule. These contracts are no longer part of our employment practice.
Last question for you while I have you. If you, you know, let's say they're going to do three more, you know, Section 5 unfair methods of competition rulemaking in the next 2 years. I mean, let's just hypothesize. What would your three be? Or even one, two, or three. Whatever your top priorities. What are your top priorities?
Great question. I think there are so many good targets. It's hard to narrow it down. So the first would be a rule prohibiting exclusive dealing and exclusionary contracting by dominant firms. And this is something that Open Markets and Broad Public Interest Coalition petitioned for in 2020. I think it's a really good target because so many dominant firms use exclusive dealing to maintain their monopoly power. The FTC has already brought a number of cases against exclusive dealing, including under Joe Simons. So I think a rulemaking is a logical next step. I think that's one. That would probably be number one on my list. Second, this might surprise you, but I don't think the agencies have fully solved the paper delay issue. The FTC has been working on it for, I think, almost 25 years now. Got partial win in the 2013 activist decision, but from what I understand, pay for delay or some iteration of it is still an issue. So I think the FTC should do rulemaking pay for delay agreements among branded and generic drug makers per se illegal.
And that was even in a recommendation in the Chopra Khan paper, if I remember correctly, right? They said that would be a good example because it was a, or was it in yours? I can't remember who did.
I'm not sure. I don't think I covered it. Maybe they did, but
I'm not surprised by that at all, because that has been ongoing for so many years and there's so much evidence of it, about it. You know, you wouldn't need a
right.
particularly long.
I think that could be a fairly quick rulemaking. They have abundant evidence. And I think what's happened here is the companies are smart. They've stopped doing straight cash for delay. Instead, they're entering into these complicated cross-licensing joint marketing agreements in which pay for delay is embedded and just happens to be the most important part of it. So I think a clear bright line against pay for delay would be good. And the third, and this is maybe a little bit more ambitious, but I'd love to see the FTC do something on pricing, specifically predatory pricing, because it's impossible to win almost impossible to win a predatory pricing case under the Sherman Act because of the Brook Group case. That's an area of law that needs to be fixed. And it's clear that a number of venture capitalists, big tech firms view predatory pricing as their straight shot to monopoly. So this would have, going after that would have significant benefits. Just imagine if Uber hadn't been able to engage in below cost pricing all these years, we might still have a vibrant licensed cab industry here in DC. But licensed cabs seem to have disappeared, but also in other cities.
Yeah. I mean, the predatory pricing thing, it's like in books, it's like it's been so long since Amazon destroyed the, you know, book, the brick and mortar book market, book companies, that they're coming back like into the Amazon spaces. Predatory pricing is, I mean, yeah, totally. There are no cabs here either.
And that would be the hardest rule in some ways, because it gets into the questions of cost accounting, what's an appropriate measure of cost. So that would be a big, big rulemaking for the FTC to undertake. But, you know, if they can get a few of these other rules done, I think that should be on their list.
That would also be hard because it's not like pay for delay and non-competes, where, to your point earlier, there are studies, economic studies, academic studies across the ideological divide on those topics, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's, you know, no one really, it's not, pay for delay is not something, you know, even like a lot of conservative economists would be like, actually, this is a good thing, right?
Right.
Predatory pricing is very dug in, you know, much more dug in terms of, you know, from an ideological clash, I think.
Yeah. And you can already imagine the company's PR efforts against the rule. The FTC wants to take away your cheap cab rides to the airport or cheap cab rides to see grandma. FTC wants to take away your affordable goods on Amazon. So it'll be politically difficult because the monopolists and the venture capitalists will position themselves as the champion of consumers.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you giving us your top three. Very interesting. We'll be very interested to see what the FTC does from here, how this plays out in the courts, what they do on unfair methods going forward. And Sandeep, thank you for being willing to do this today and in the 10 years the Capital Forum since we started, and it was a pleasure chatting with you.
Yeah, thanks so much. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Second Request. Second Request is powered by the Capital Forum. For more information, connect with us at thecapitalforum.com or follow us on Twitter at capital_forum.